Besides being naive, Edgar was impolitic. Still, Britain now took oil seriously. Also in 1921, Lord Curzon, Britain's foreign secretary, dismissed U.S. demands on behalf of Standard Oil. No concessions, he said, would be allowed to American companies in Mesopotamia or elsewhere in the British Middle East. The United States, Curzon suggested, already had all the oil it needed. By this point, Washington, too, acted as if it half-owned Standard Oil, and national honor was at stake. The State Department pressed the British and Dutch with counter-threats. Congress, already launching investigations, could decide to prohibit oil investments by foreigners or to designate British and Dutch-owned U.S. oil fields as naval reserves, so as to bar any resale. The Bank of England also depended on U.S. central bankers supporting the wobbly British pound, as the New York Federal Reserve Bank did several times during the 1920s. By 1925, both explicit and veiled pressures from Washington had obliged Britain to open up Iraq to Standard of New Jersey and Saucony. The two received a 20% share in the new Iraq Petroleum Company. Standard of New Jersey also took over the former German oil concessions in the Dutch East Indies. One American historian has pithily summarized, "To some, these successive intercessions in behalf of oil were viewed as fulfilling the moral purposes and political needs of the natural overseas extension of 19th century manifest destiny. To the less reverent, they earned Charles E. Hughes, Secretary of State from 1921 to 1925, the title of Secretary for Oil. And more significantly, these moves announced that the United States and its corporate citizens were now in truth world powers, with continuing economic interests on every continent. Looking back from the 21st century, we can call oil supremacy a game the United States always played to win." Herbert Hoover, the oil-wise U.S. Commerce Secretary, would have welcomed sharing Hughes's putative title. By one brisk interpretation, he privately asked Standard Oil of New Jersey to ingratiate itself with Arab culture and turn the oil sheiks away from the Brits and Germans toward the red, white, and blue. Or as one Gulf Oil executive recalled, representatives of the industry were called to Washington and told to go out and get it. Within a decade or so, American dealmakers had taken their cue. In 1927, Pittsburgh-headquartered Gulf, owned by the family of Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon, bought the oil concession in Kuwait, soon taking the Anglo-Persian Oil Company into partnership there to satisfy the British. The next year, SoCal won the franchise in Bahrain, and by 1933, it had also arranged a concession from Saudi ruler Abdulaziz ibn Saud, whose territory had unwisely been ignored by the British. Then in 1936, SoCal and Texaco negotiated a deal to split the combined Saudi Arabian and Bahraini concession evenly between them, for which SoCal in return picked up a share of Texaco's fields in the Dutch East Indies. 2 years later, the left-leaning Mexican government of President Lázaro Cárdenas nationalized foreign oil holdings, squeezing the British out of another nation where they had made strong inroads before 1914. Though still 90% coal-burning at home, Britain did significantly enlarge its overseas oil resources between the world wars. Nevertheless, as important Middle East producers took on American relationships, the United Kingdom lost any real hope of perpetuating its economic hegemony into the new oil era. Indeed, it fell short well before the deeper dislocations that accompanied World War II. By the 30s, U.S. oil companies overseas found themselves in quasi-official positions roughly comparable to those of Royal Dutch, Shell, and Anglo-Persian in the British orbit. Senior American oilmen were a kind of auxiliary diplomatic and foreign service, while the firms themselves could count on Washington help. In The Seven Sisters, Anthony Sampson concluded that, to radical critics, it looked as if the State Department had simply abdicated the whole process of oil diplomacy to the oilmen. The government, however much they might distrust the oilmen, were not prepared to set up their own organization. They preferred to use the oil companies, at a discreet distance, as the instruments of national security and foreign policy. No other U.S. industry had a comparable position.